Hi, everybody, and welcome to this special episode of the Kamide Podcast. I'm your host, Subi Sade. On this episode, I was joined by legendary inspector and founder of Live Oak QA, Peter Baker. I heard about Peter when I was reading Catherine Ebon's book, Bottle of Lies. I interviewed Catherine a few months back. She described Peter as a motorcycle-riding, tattooed, tough guy. I also looked at Retica Systems did a profile on YouTube of Peter Baker, and so I was able to see what the outputs of inspections look like. He has done a lot of work around data integrity. We talk about his experience working with FDA, starting from his time in the San Francisco office and culminating in his experiences in international locations like China and India. He talks about the diverse areas he focused in, from food to medical devices, clinical trials, even imports. Peter talks about his inspection methods, how he was a little bit unconventional in how he approached GMP inspections overseas, and he talks about what he found there. He talks about where he thinks most data integrity issues come from, some of the guidances and frameworks that have been set forth in industry more recently to help deal with those issues. He talks about what he thinks inspection readiness looks like in the year 2024 and how that is not the same as the compliance-driven inspection readiness that has been in the past. If you want to get in touch with Peter, you can find him at liveoakqa.com. He has a great blog there. We talk about one blog post in particular that I thought was really interesting around addressing unknown discrepancies. And with that, here is the episode with Peter.
Hello, Combi Nation. My name is Subi Sade. I've spent over a decade in medical device, pharma, and combination product development. Our industry feels complicated sometimes. Drugs, devices, clinical trials, submissions, sterilization, validation, design control, risk management, market access, reimbursement. The list goes on. My goal is mastery. So this podcast is to ask questions I have to people who may have the answers. Each week on the Combinate Podcast, I talk to someone about their area to further understand and simplify. Whether you're a pharma person trying to understand the next wave of products, or a device person trying to navigate a pharma system you're unfamiliar with, or a newbie in both areas, I invite you to listen, and together we can simplify by combinating.
You spent the first few years in San Francisco before you went international. And so
yeah.
I had it maybe put together that did you start off in food?
We start in those days. So this was before program alignment that happened around the mid 2010s times. Before that, it wasn't that you were dedicated to any one program area. So you do foods one day and then devices, and then you do some BIMO work, which is like evaluation of clinical trials. That's all changed now. But back in those days, that was supposed to give you this, and imports, I forgot about that. Like really your first year was a lot of import work, which was cool because it gave you an idea of the different areas that FDA regulates, and you know, then you could choose if you wanted to specialize in any one of those areas. Of course, depends on your background and your interests and things like that. But yeah, it was just a great experience.
When you say imports, can you dive deeper into that?
Yeah. It'd be like some product might be held up by customs due to some issue, labeling, examination required, or storage condition would be under question. So you'd go out to those bonded warehouses, examine that stuff, or if it wasn't found to meet our expectations, you would go to the dump and actually witness it being run over by a bulldozer and then document all that in the internal systems, and just to make sure that products coming in were safe and met the expectations of FDA and other agencies.
And so that last bit about the bulldozer, that's like a certification of destruction for non-compliant material thing?
That's right. Yeah. Like, for example, you might have a barrel of fish coming in that doesn't have the require amount of salt content. So it has to be destroyed because it could cause serious adverse effects on anyone who consumed it. So you have to go watch it being destroyed and then document it.
Interesting.
Or acid on it or all kinds of cool things.
Geez. And so at some point, I think I saw in the 2010-ish timeframe, they started to align. And at the same time, you said around the 2010s, that was also, if my memory serves me right, when you decided to take the jump and move overseas.
Yeah, I took that jump in 2012. The real alignment didn't like officially happen until I believe around 2015 or 16 time, the true alignment where you don't really do much crossover these days post the program realignment. Yep. That happened around 2015, 16.
What drove you to go? You started in India first.
That's right. Yep. I had always enjoyed international travel. I had lived in China before, actually, from 2003 to 2004. And just had just a wonderful experience. It was in the southern part of China, right above the Vietnam border, actually. And really enjoyed my time there. And I thought, hey, I could actually do this as part of a job, go live abroad. And I also wanted to become an expert in aseptic manufacturing. And that's where, at that time, there was just an explosion of companies opening up new or renovated aseptic facilities that were planning to export to the U.S. So I'm like, hey, I could live abroad and hone my skills on auditing or understanding aseptic manufacturing.
Yeah. And so that was actually something that came across in the book is like you were going there to learn the cutting edge.
That's right. Yep.
Yeah.
That was the plan.
Yeah. And so what was it like once you got there? How was the office set up?
Oh, yeah. In those days, actually, it was spread out into two different locations. It was in Mumbai and Delhi. I chose Delhi as my point just because I wanted to be in the embassy rather than in a consulate. Just because that's
where. What does that mean?
Oh, the embassy is actually based in Delhi, right? So that's the main base. The State Department and all the different agencies that work overseas. And then you may have some agencies, of course, the consular division, of course, that would work in these satellite offices. They're called consulates around the country. They're smaller, still do very similar work, but it's not the center of the action. Although Mumbai is a more desirable, in my opinion, place to live, that might make some people angry there, but Delhi was where I chose to live.
So I hadn't put that together that you as a government employee and being there to do some kind of work would have to fit in some kind of diplomatic chain. And so you, the FDA local offices that are OUS all report in through the embassies.
That's right. All reporting through the ambassador.
Is that right?
Yep.
Wow. And what about when you were doing the inspection reporting? Is there a center here that you would report to, or you would have a main leadership in the local in the embassy that would be the top person, and that's it?
Yeah, you have your local supervisors and office director. Those are in country, always based in the embassy. And then you have, of course, reporting into a larger structure within FDA, which in those days was called Office of International Programs, or OIP. That's where your ultimate reporting structure ended up, but your reports would go through your traditional supervisory chain of command, just like in a district office.
What did you find once you got there to India?
I found that indeed there was an explosion of sites going up, new sites or renovated sites. There's just a lot of action going on in those days. And so it was a fun time to be there. You could pretty much choose the type of inspections that you wanted to take. If you wanted to do aseptic manufacturing this week, sure, those are available. You want to do API? Sure. Yeah, those are available. It's just a really great chance to pick something and hone your skills if you wanted to. Whereas if I was still based in the San Francisco district office, didn't have that same level of choice. So you would just go with whatever was nearby your office. And so, yeah, it was a good way to just load yourself up with what you wanted to work on for the future of your career.
When did you start to see some of the issues that you were discovering? Was it early on, or was it something that was slow moving?
I had seen those issues before, right? Even in inspections near my local district office. And there wasn't, so this was the days, remember, before FDA published, or any of the regulators, I should say, published any guidance on data integrity. So although data integrity was supposed to be built into the regulation, right? It was just, it's just an expectation of good science. Really, there shouldn't be a need for a data integrity guidance, but in those days, folks were maybe not adhering to, everywhere in the world, we're not adhering to good science practices, right? We might call them data integrity now, but really they're just principles of good science. If you get a result that doesn't necessarily meet your expectations for purity or potency or whatever, you're supposed to report that, right? All of the results, and not maybe conclude that, oh, I probably spilled something during the sample preparation, so let me just do it again and just to confirm. Then if it passes the second time, maybe I just won't report the earlier result that I didn't necessarily like. And so it pretty much started off right off the bat, the first couple of inspections. And so unfortunately, I didn't really get to achieve my goal of really focusing on aseptic manufacturing because I got so distracted in that area of data integrity. But I was already distracted in that area. So I'm not sure what I'm sure I was surprised, because it was going on everywhere. This was, again, before the regulatory guidance had been published in 2015.
Did you see so most of my career has been, I think data integrity was being talked about before that guidance came out. And so typically the guidance are, this is my opinion, could be completely wrong. There's like the last thing to come after.
Yeah, unfortunately.
The cat's typically out of the bag, right? So
yeah.
It's not like the guidance comes out and it's like this new era of now data integrity is a thing. There's years of lead up. And then the guidance becomes the new, we call it state of the art or whatever on the device side from a risk management point of view. This is the new minimum bar. The data integrity is not like this cutting edge thing. It's the bare minimum.
Right.
And so did you find that there was a meaningful shift once that guidance came out?
Oh, that's a good question. A meaningful shift. See, the key word I think you mentioned there is meaningful. I think so. I think there was a meaningful shift. It wasn't enough. And so it took a second publication actually by PIX that didn't come out until 2021 on data governance that really forced the meaningful shift. Our first efforts were really just based on Alcoa Plus, and these are great foundational concepts, and I think management thought you just train somebody on how to document contemporaneously and this will fix this whole DI issue. It won't, right? So training, hard work, best efforts, whatever you want to call it, that doesn't fix problems, structural problems with process design. So data governance steps in now, and this is what's going to force the real meaningful shift that we all need. It's defined as the sum total of arrangements, right? Because everyone thought the root cause of data integrity was people. It's not even close, right? Maybe less than 1% of the cases are actually due to people. 99% due to design issues.
So interesting. So I guess from what you just said you said the root cause of data integrity issues is 99% of the time, not people.
That's right. But everybody wants to, you want me to go on there? Yeah.
Yeah.
Everybody wants to focus on the human factor, right? Because that's the easy part. Yeah, so this is the easy way out. generally in life, the easy way out isn't the right way out, right? That list of those types of situations goes on and on.
I think broadly speaking, like all my training in managing deviations, investigations is like, for you to identify human as root cause, you really gotta discount everything. And then once you get to that point, you need everybody's approval for you to actually assign it. That's what I've seen in large companies, right? And so what is the 99% of the root cause then?
The 99% comes down to a failure to ensure right environment. Interestingly enough, the MHRA original guidance for data integrity published in 2015 had a whole section on this concept of right environment, right? Which it doesn't give it quite the details that we see in the PICS guidance for data governance, but it hints to it. It says, look, if you want somebody to record something contemporaneously, make sure that the computer system where they're supposed to enter these results for CFUs or whatever they're doing are actually there in the room, right? That's a right environment. You can't train someone to record something contemporaneously and then not provide them with enough laptops. Or that's a kind of an extreme example, but the examples get much more subtle. Even subtle challenges to a right environment can result in data integrity issues that I would do the same thing. See, that's the thing. Like if you don't give me that right design, these subtle things matter, right? Eventually, especially when I'm under pressure, I'm going to resort to getting the job done, regardless of the means.
Were there any like red flags that you would look for? Like in particular, a punch list? Oh, they have to walk across the room to enter the result? Like the instrument is far away from the laptop, or anything that was like immediately, okay, time for me to double click on this area?
One of the biggest red flags would be you just ask, like, how do you like control your paperwork? And they may say they have some procedural controls, right? Oh, we train people to only print one copy, or it's et cetera, et cetera. That's what you would be trained to know as an investigator, as that is called a trigger, right? And then your target is, all right, I bet you that there's going to be 2, 3, 4 copies of these records because they're relying on training or procedural controls alone to ensure data integrity. Just go straight to the dumpster, wherever that might be around the facility. Bring your gloves along, bring your mask, and get started and see what you find in there.
Now, one of the things that came across in Catherine's book was that you were unconventional in how you would approach audits. Like typically, or inspections, typically what I've seen is like the standard opening presentation, tours, and all of that, and you would avoid them?
I actually, one time I did it, my very first foreign trip for FDA was actually in China, and I did a 2-month trip there, and that's called a TDY, and I wrote some reports, and I used the word temporary duty. And so I was based there out of the consulate in Shanghai, and I thought I was doing an excellent job. I did 6 inspections, and I wrote these reports up and sent them back, and I got a call from the center, and they're like, okay, we need to have a chat, right? Because in the next, I'm like, okay, I'm all nervous, right? I'm a kind of a new investigator, firstborn trip. I get on the call, and they're like, in your report, you use the word tour. Yeah, I went on a laboratory tour, or I toured the manufacturing facility. And they said, what do you think about that? And I remember just being terrified, right? Because he's just like senior management in FDA. I'm like, okay. Oh, okay. And then it clicked. I'm like, they're asking me to rephrase this, right? But they want me to do it. They don't want to tell me what to do. They want me to understand why I made this mistake on this report, because an investigator never takes a tour, right? They inspect, they investigate. And so that really changed that really molded me, I think, from a really early time in my FDA career, you don't ever take a tour, right? You're there to protect and promote public health, and tours aren't gonna achieve that, right? You're an investigator. There's a reason. There's rationale behind the use of that term, drug investigator, that FDA uses. Not all agencies use that, right? They might use inspector, right? But there's deliberate rationale behind the use of that investigator term in the FDA world.
Okay, I'm going to push back a little bit, just so I understand. So, okay, fine. But if I'm, for example, like when I bought my house, right, there was the inspector that came in to make sure everything was okay. They don't know where everything is at. And this is like a pretty bad example. Manufacturing facilities are absolutely enormous. I get what you're saying on principle, right? You're not being led is the main takeaway, but also at the same time, you're walking into a huge site. Like you can't just go in and from the jump, you need to like at least have a walkthrough with somebody who knows what the site is.
Oh, certainly. They need to be there for sure. That would definitely be included in the investigation. But I like your analogy there of the home inspector, which is totally different. That really is an inspector, right? They come in with a checklist according to your local code. They make sure, for example, your water heater has an emergency drain outside of your home and those things. But they're not going to investigate but an investigator, they might see the failure to do that and say, okay, something triggered me there, right? With the way this house was designed, I'm going to dig way further, right? So I'm going to go from that water heater, then I'm going to go connect it to the HVAC, then I'm going to connect it to the gas lines, right? And put this entire story together to the end that says why you should not buy this house. I wish that home inspectors acted more like investigators, to be honest with you. I've gone through it twice, like buying a home, right? And I did not get a whole lot of value out of either of those experiences. And I think because of that reason, there's not much critical thinking involved. No offense against them. That's their role. But imagine if they came in with their critical thinking hat in combination with their checklist. How much more value that would add to your home buying experience.
Yeah. So you mentioned you did 6 inspections in 2 months, or I think that's what you said. Was there an element of, whoa, slow down? Because that seems like a lot.
No, that was, slow down is not a word I think I heard in FDA ever.
Oh.
I think it was how many can you get done in 2 months?
What about the, because I know that you had like a high warning letter kind of output percentage per, even Redica did a profile on you on YouTube. I thought it was really interesting, but percentages, the findings or the classification or pressing the same buttons and so on. If every inspection that you go to, people are getting a warning letter for data integrity.
Yeah, no, I had just the most amazing mentors in FDA, whether it was from ORA, which is the field division, OIP, which is the foreign division, or CEDAR, who ultimately handled the cases to decide on the final classification. I don't think I got lucky because I think that those resources exist everywhere in the agency. It's just really dedicated, hardworking people that are there. I remember calling because the time difference between Delhi and DC is insane. But I remember calling during an inspection and people picking up, right, in DC, which I imagine was the middle of the night, to provide guidance on what exhibits I needed to collect, which photos I might need to build this case, or the list goes on. It was like full-time support. Which was because you're out there alone. It can be very challenging, very stressful.
One thing that maybe surprised you is that it's uncommon for companies to never reject batches. and you were seeing that there were some instances where it was like, if you're accepting everything, there might be a problem. And where did that come from?
The first time I understood, I'd heard about that in training. Hey, make sure you know that folks, when they see an OS, they reject it. Of course, that's part of your training. But I had never seen like how folks, I was never really trained like on the subtle the techniques that folks use to do this. I remember the first time I saw it, they were taking products that had failed for impurity and then blending it in with batches that had passed for this particular impurity because they couldn't control the temperature of one of their reactors. It was getting too old. So it was causing this impurity to be present, but not in all batches. So they took the bad batches and then would subtly blend them in with the good ones and then tested again and again until it finally got under the level that they needed. And that was eye-opening, right? Because I'm like, oh, wow, like everybody's in on this.
So that's like cutting it, right?
Just cutting it. Yeah, that's exactly what it is. It's cutting an API before you make your finished dose. But the problem is you can never validate that. So some patients are going to get product that is going to meet expectations for safety and efficacy, and some aren't, depending on which vial you get. And which,
that's crazy,
when early or late in the batch, and that's sad.
Yeah. The dual track multi-tier quality expectations, where I think you as a foreign inspector, you have limited jurisdiction as to only product that is intended for your market, right? So you don't have any jurisdiction over product that's, let's say, manufactured in country X, but is intended for not the US.
You do have jurisdiction if it's under the same quality system, right? And so you'll see on warning letters, like even today, they'll say, we acknowledge that this batch was not bound for the US, but it's the same quality system. So why did you test it in a compliance? Provide your response. Yeah. So I would always do that. And I would say those facilities were always interesting to me, and I would go into them. And oftentimes, I'd say 50% of the time, I'd find them secretly manufacturing product for the US because they'd use a US batch number, right? And then that case would fall apart. It was easy to build those cases because...
Meaning the case would fall apart because, okay, you're reviewing an OUS document, but it's all the same equipment, all the same systems.
Yeah.
You don't have to be a rocket scientist to say you're using the same system and equipment.
Not necessarily. They'd even be in the same facility. It might be on a different unit across the campus. But that's fair game. It's the same quality unit. Go take a look. We did. You know, that I think that's probably why some folks thought it was a little bit non-traditional, our inspections that we were doing in the foreign offices, because I think in the old days before the foreign offices, folks didn't really do that. They would just stick on this kind of like, almost, I hate to say, but almost like a tour, right? Where we were investigating. We had the time to investigate, right? Because we were there. If I needed to extend my inspection by a day, I just did it. So it allowed for those types of techniques.
You run a blog yourself as part of Live Oak. And one of the things that you talked about, actually, before I'll X this question and ask the question differently. Okay. Through all of the inspections that you saw, it seemed like lab controls, data integrity were the kind of Pareto chart. They were the area where you found the most issues and issued the most OAIs, 483s, warning letters, etc. Why do you think that is? Because in my head, I would think a failure in validation or something else would be the case. That kind of surprised me.
Yeah. I think the reason behind that is if you're really messing with data out in production, it takes quite a bit of effort. Like you may have to reprocess the entire batch or something like that. And you're going to create a lot of paper trail, right? If you do that, even if you're going to try to falsify it, you're leaving a lot of tracks in the snow. And those tracks are what the investigators are looking for, right? And you slip up a little bit and that's big, right? But in QC, on the other hand, it's such a small area, right? Where you have just one analyst, maybe a second analyst reviewing it and one system, right? So rather than reprocess this entire batch, just make the data pass, right? Everyone knows that complaints really don't get logged. How are you going to trace back an adverse event to a drug, right? It's going to be their allergic reaction, or it's going to be medical error, or way before it's going to be traced back to a bad product, right? So why not just falsify the data in QC? It's easy. It just takes log in as an admin, set the clock back to yesterday and retest it. That's 10 clicks. I can theoretically reprocess an entire batch, make it pass. So it's just the ease, I think. That's why I focused on QC. It's because people just take the least path of resistance when you're talking about doing criminal activity. They just take the path of least resistance, which is QC.
Did you find a distinction between what was the spread of the sort of primary citation that you would see in those overseas markets different than what you would see in the US?
Not really. It would be it was really the same, like testing into compliance. My sample size was just much larger overseas because that's where I was based. Because I mentioned in San Francisco, we were doing like imports and devices. And one of my most interesting cases that I ever did was actually a GLP inspection in the Bay Area. So that's like the preclinical trials. And oh my goodness, the amount of the data was just complete falsified. Sitting in the director's office and there was a folder on the table called trials. And I'm like, what's that? Like the clinical trials, preclinical trials? He's like, no, that's where we pre-test the samples before we run the official analysis. I'm like, oh, okay, go on. Yeah. And I was like, wow, this is amazing. You're just going to admit to me that you're doing this.
Yeah. And so there is a distinction between GMP and non-GMP in this sense, that the exploratory cases would be that testing to try and understand what expectations are. But if you're doing something that is GMP or for human use, those kinds of things are unacceptable.
Yeah, it's the same for the GXP lifecycle. If you're talking about preclinical, clinical, or commercial, it's the expectations for good science, which align perfectly with data integrity, are the same. Yeah, because they're all used in the application approval process, which there was a recent court ruling, and I loved the judge said, this is serious because this data is a clinical trial falsification in Florida. And the judge says, this data is the cornerstone of FDA approval. And so don't mess with it, basically.
Now, what made you transition to industry?
I was worn out. Yeah, I was worn out. Hence a lot of inspections and, you know, it wears you out, like always being the one who's bringing bad news, right? And I thought, I kind of want to take a break from that for a while. So I'm going to do something where I just focus on training and empowering people. I like that because, again, I truly believe that these 99% of the cases are processes, right? So let's fix the processes, right? And stop blaming people for basically being human. So I'll eventually go back for sure in some way to the FDA, but for now I'm enjoying what I'm doing now.
Do you do a lot of inspection readiness work?
No.
No?
I do training, yeah.
That's it?
I think my inspection days are taken over. They're on hold for a moment.
But what would you recommend for people prepare? Obviously, every day is preparation for inspection. Every time There's that general saying of the next time it's going to be reviewed will be by FDA once you approve the document. And so I get that. But what do you recommend in terms of inspection readiness, having seen what you've seen? Is there any, like, you've been in the front room as the person everybody's trying to present to? Are there some front rooms that are more successful than others?
There are, and it's the ones that have transitioned away. You mentioned inspection readiness, right? So there's two camps. There's one that focuses on compliance, and then there's another one who focuses on quality. The front room that focuses on quality and the way they present their work to the investigator are going to be the ones that succeed. In my opinion, that's inspection readiness in 2024 and probably well into the future. Because if you're focusing, and there's a lot that comes with quality, right? Focusing on risk to patient, like where are your sources of variability? Because compliance just says, do you have an SOP? Do you have a training program? That's an auditor, right? Yes, I have that. Do you have a data integrity risk assessment? Yes. But have you evaluated the workflow? Have you evaluated the sources of variability? Have you fixed the gaps? Are you monitoring the residual risk? That's inspection readiness. Prepare someone to be inspection ready in 2024 without empowering them to think critically. And so that's, I think, what I would recommend. It's just, if you want to talk about inspection ready, just empower your people to think critically and own their processes.
You have a blog on your Live Oak site, and it looks like you put something out like once a month-ish, once every couple months, right?
Yes, that's right.
One of the blogs that I thought was really interesting was unknown discrepancies. And you say that this continues to be the number one cited GMP year after year, often leading to warning letters, recalls, et cetera. Why is that?
I think it's a pretty good follow-up, actually, to that last point. It's why is 211-192 almost always the number one observation, right? Which is basically failure to do adequate investigations. So that could be a deviation in OOS or whatever. They all fall under 211-192. And I think it's this lingering problem of compliance. So management expects these QA associates or whoever is supposed to be doing these investigations to conclude 0 or 100 as far as the risk, right? So we either have to recall or there's no risk. There's no in between. Whereas if we just acknowledge the uncertainty, basically if we acknowledge what we know and what we don't know, and that generally it's going to be somewhere in between 0 and 100, we can actually come up with investigations that will meet regulatory expectations in 2024. But if you're going to try to conclude 0, it's not going to work. Right? The investigator's just going to poke holes in your root cause or product impact or whatever. And you're not going to be able to answer it because you're like, oh, like if I admit that, then I couldn't conclude 0 that my management was expecting to conclude. So I couldn't put that into the deviation. That's sad.
When you say 0, can you walk through that a little bit more?
Yeah, like it's management. I think it's management's old school management's expectations that the conclusion of this investigation, again, OOS or whatever, is either no risk, which is 0, or too much risk. That means recall, right? And so, but in reality, something went wrong. It was a deviation, right? So there was some increased risk. Otherwise, it wouldn't have been a deviation in the first place. So admit that, right? Yeah. You might be outside of your validated processes. It doesn't mean you have to recall the batch. It just means you have to do the work to determine if you need to recall the batch or not, right? Most likely not, right? But you got to do the work. You can't just make the conclusion, oh, 0 risk or no risk. Admit what you know and what you don't know about what happened in the event, and you will always make the right decision. The problem is we were never trained to do that, in school. Grade school, high school to university, right? We were trained that, hey, if you studied the material and attended the lectures, you can get 100% on the test. Even if you studied extra, you can get 110%, right? But when you open a deviation, there's no way you can get 100%, right? Like you're gonna struggle. It's gonna be hard, right? There's no right or wrong answer. And we struggle with that, right? Because we weren't trained to think like this. So again, this focus on empowerment of people to think critically, we can overcome this challenge that we have.
Yeah. It's interesting because a lot of the data integrity stuff I was being trained on as I was coming into industry and all the stuff that you're talking about now, I don't want to say almost feels foreign to me, but like the idea of applying some kind of pageantry to a deviation just feels like crazy. Just write down what happened, who discovered it, if there's a reason that you didn't open it within the day or whatever the time frame that you were supposed to open it, write why I didn't have access to the system or I needed to get a certain thing or the approver was on vacation or whatever. You don't need to sugarcoat it because at the end of the day, things happen. Just write down what actually happened, though.
Love though. I'd never heard that before, and I might steal that from you, Subi. Pageantry that goes into these investigations. I think that's a great way of summing it up. It's get over the pageantry, man. Just be honest with what you know and what you don't know. Focused on patient safety, and you'll be fine.
I think for me, what's helped me, it's like I didn't make it. I wasn't the person that was on the line. It takes literally thousands of people to design, develop, manufacture, and so on. And so I think this idea of assigning blame or show me who to fire or whatever, like this idea that after an inspection, that's what's going to happen. There's a really good book called Do Quality Differently, written by two authors, Cliff Barry and Amy Wilson. One of them they both have worked in Big Pharma for a long time, and they're like very much against this idea of human error being the root cause of everything. And so I interviewed them, and Amy said something really interesting, that for her, ownership is not falling on your sword or being happy to take blame, and that ownership is when something happens, you're fixing it. And so I see a deviation, okay, unless it's malicious or unless it's like a true personal integrity issue where somebody was falsifying something deliberately against our processes and so on, then it's like, okay, there's an issue with this product. What is the root cause? Am I addressing it? Effectiveness check, and actually fixing the problem, not assigning blame. Where can people, one question for you is, what's a book that changed
your life?
Thanks
for that book, by the way. I wrote down that Do Quality Differently. Thanks for that.
Do Quality, What's a book that changed your life?
The Wager.
The Wager. What's it about?
The thing is, life is hard. Work is hard. We all know that, right? And sometimes it's nice to read. Like, so that book, The Wager, is about an incredible story of human, I don't know if the right word is resilience or survival. And it's a good reminder that, like, man, sometimes when things like seem tough, hard, right, that people have gone through things and come out okay on the other side. It's amazing what we're capable of as humans, right? That book really, I think, puts it in perspective.
And it's a story?
It's a story, yeah, a true story of a ship. It's the 1600s, right, that sailed, not with good intentions, that's the problem. It was going to go steal some gold from Spain, but ended up getting shipwrecked. And it's a new book, I think, released in 2023. And it is an incredible story. They get shipwrecked, and it's the trials that they went through, just insane. And then I just, from time to time, remember that when I'm like, man, I feel really challenged right now, or I feel like this is tough. Like, then I'm like, man, I can get through this, right? I can succeed because people have gone through some really challenging things in life and come out on the other side. Okay.
Every, I run and I've done triathlons and stuff like that. And One of the things that I really like is run the mile you're in as just a mindset, like this mile will end, the every storm runs out
there you
of
go.
Rain. Those yeah. kinds of things really resonate very well with me. Where can people find you, Peter?
Oh, you can find me on LinkedIn, of course, and www.liveoakqa.com.
Thank you for coming on to the show. This was awesome.
Thanks for inviting me. This was a lot of fun.